can you just meet them once? And I declined that also. Until one day he gave me a demo himself, because I refused to even spend half an hour. He gave me a demo. I loved the demo so much. I said, I got to meet. And in my last 10 years, the fastest check I have wrote was WhatFix. In 3 days from my first meeting, I wrote the check. Siddharth, we are probably amongst the more measured slow investors. We are blamed for it too. Last year, we saw about 4,000 deals and bagged only 8 companies last year. That's all we did, in fact. I think the most important thing for founders in the current situation, in my opinion, is to reduce burn. At the later stages, the metric actually I worry about the most is net new ARR added divided by the net burn in a quarter. And if that ratio is more than 1, you're healthy. If that ratio is less than 1, you're not so healthy. I'm personally a big believer of backing new / emerging categories than existing categories. 60, 70 years of software can actually be compressed into 4 or 5 cycles. That's it, actually. There is the mainframe era. There is the mini era. There is a client server era. Then there is the 3-tier or the web or the .com, whatever name we give it, was created. And the cloud, right? And if you were to fast forward even from now, let's say 2003 to 2013, cloud was a completely different landscape, right? I think in 10 years, AI will be a completely, completely different landscape. The amount of new software that is getting created or needs to be created, the pace of growth of that is far higher than the number of new software developers. For that equation to add up, software productivity just has to go up. There is no other way, or we will not have the software, yes. Right?
Hi, this is Siddharth Ahluwalia. Welcome to 100X Entrepreneur Podcast. Today, I have with me a very dear friend and a person who I really aspire to be in investing, Alok Goyal, Managing Partner, Stellaris Ventures. Alok, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Siddharth. You're putting me on too high a pedestal. I don't think you want to be me, and it's great to be back on this platform again.
So we are doing this with Alok after 2.5 years. The one we did was like pre-COVID era, and glad to be doing this. And we are a very monumental moment, right? Alok, you are known like among the top 3 or 4 people in SaaS investing in India. Right.
Very kind of you to say that, Siddharth.
And people like want to have you on their cap table, right? It's just that you have like very few checks to write in a year. And some of the founders, they vouch that, wish we could have Alok on a cap table. But coming to SaaS in India, right, what we're going to discuss about is how SaaS has changed in the last 10 years and what is the next few years looking for Indian SaaS companies. For example, if we go back to 2010-11, right? The only SaaS companies in India, there were a couple of them, Zoho and Freshworks, and they both had just, Zoho was like 10 plus years old, Freshworks was 2 years old, and a term called SaaS unicorn didn't existed back then. People never believed that Indian SaaS could even exist.
Yeah.
And today we have a company which has achieved $1 billion in yearly revenue, that's Zoho. Freshworks has listed on NASDAQ, becoming one of the first Indian SaaS companies to do that. And they are at 500 mil ARR, whatever people say about the valuation, right?
Yeah.
Last year, they were at 370 mil. This year, they are at 500 mil. I think soon, 3 years down the line, they might be touching the $1 billion
true.
ARR mark. Like truly true. A dream come true for the Indian SaaS. And right. You have lived this dream for the last 10 years. You were the partner who was bought into Helion to look at enterprise SaaS. Now you built Stellaris over the last 5 years. Right? How has SaaS changed? You have observed this very closely. SaaS changed in India for global in the last 10 years.
So Siddharth, quite a dramatic change. And if I may almost admit, far more than I had imagined it. When I came into Helion, in fact, in January, I complete my 10 years in this profession. Hard to believe. SaaS was not something that was a desirable sector, if I may say, for most investors. There were literally 3 or 4 of us who had a bit of a tag of a SaaS on their head. I think it's fair to say we were like an outcast in our industry at that point. Very few companies that used to come out. I think when I started, you're right, that Freshwork was probably just about crossing a million ARR. Accel had done the round and Tiger had already done the round there. But there weren't that many examples to go by. You're right, Zoho was there, but Zoho was also treated separately because it was not built through venture capital. So lots of questions, even though it's interesting that Helion had hired me to build the SaaS practice. But internally, you had to climb a mountain to get a deal through the IC because everything else was acceptable, but SaaS was very difficult at that point in time. So coming from a point where very few companies, pretty much no scaled company, very little money, very few investors, very little ecosystem to talk of. So they weren't successful SaaS founders, for example. We had iSpirit that had just started. Sharad had started that, which was, I thought, a great initiative. And the NASSCOM Product Council. But we were sort of trying to find our identity within that place. You fast forward 10 years. My actually summary of this is that I think we have found a product market fit. I think it's for venture as a whole. For SaaS in particular, I think that's the case. And while there will be skeptics for all these numbers, but the fact that we have created 15 to 20 unicorns, we did the first IPO in Freshworks, Zoho crossing $1 billion, just the number of companies that have crossed $100 million. I think in many ways, I think of it as, I remember when I joined McKinsey, we used to teach this, there used to be this cost curve that they used to show for manufacturing, and they used to call that the experience curve. Saying that with every year of doing something, you get better incrementally by 10 to 15%. If you begin to compound that 10 to 15%, the result is actually pretty amazing. And I think if you look at 10 years, we have seen that compounding at a much higher rate than a 10 to 15% that I would apply to it. So I don't think there is a question mark on India's ability to create large, successful global SaaS companies today.
And you have a couple of them from your portfolio today. WhatFix.
We have been very fortunate. So I was fortunate, first of all, that even though from a bit of a distance, but I could see the journeys of some of the companies we funded in Helion as well, like PubMatic,
yeah,
Gupshup. Thereafter, we had more engaged from Helion as well. And you're right. In fact, I started my journey with WhatFix in Helion. And then that was the first company we backed out of Stellaris as well. And through them, I have learned a lot. There is also Extria, which is a mixture of software and services that I was part of earlier. But then at Stellaris, we have had Signzy, Slintel, GTM Buddy, LimeChat, and many others that we have had a chance to be with. And I think the big change I'm seeing is that there was one single thesis of building a SaaS company from India. And that thesis was existing category, because in an existing category, you can use inbound channels like a Google search, content marketing to be able to build a demand gen engine. Sell it to SMBs, low price point. You can put remote salespeople, so inside sales from India, 1/10 the cost. And therefore, the unit economics of selling works out. And that was the recipe that you could go with. Today, you don't need a recipe from India. I don't think there is a kind of company you can't build from India today. You can build for the SMB. You can build for the enterprise. You can build classical sales-led. You can build product-led. You can build classical closed source. You can build open source. I don't think SaaS can be put in a box today from India today, therefore.
And when you look from the lens of Stellaris, what's your aspiration for your companies to become?
So that's same as everybody else. We want to create global category leaders in the end.
And what's your definition of global category leader? Is there a milestone that a company hits?
In general, I don't define category leader only as a revenue threshold, because see, I think the beauty of B2B businesses in general is that there can be yet another company which can again have customers, right? This is not a Facebook where there are network effects and you cannot have another one. But even in SaaS, you will find that in every category, there is like a massive market leader, which will be the outlier, 40, 50, 60% market share. There'll be two or three others, anywhere between 10 to 20, 30% kind of market share. And then there's a long tail. And the market attributes a lot of premium and value to the market leader. Maybe the two or three after that. But the long tail, even if they have revenue, actually doesn't get the premium. So as an investor, it's actually not worthwhile. You can actually get to a company which is a 100 million outcome, but they may not actually get any premium for it. And therefore, intent is to create market leaders ultimately, right? And that's what we aspire for. I know that ours is a profession where we have massive long list of mistakes and very few things to show in the end. I just hope that by the time I call it quits, I have a few to show as well. But yeah, that's the hope.
Hi, everyone. Before we begin, I would like to share that this podcast is brought to you by Prime Venture Partners, an early stage VC fund led by Amit Somani, Shripati Acharya, and Sanjay Swami. Prime is often the first institutional investor in category defining tech startups in fintech, SaaS, healthcare, and education, such as MyGate, Quizzes, Planet Spark, Bolt and Clip. To know more about Prime, visit primevp.in.
And you already have, right? WhatFix is one of the poster childs from India, helping large and Fortune 500 enterprises in US, right, with implementation of SAP, Salesforce. So is there a similar pattern that you are imagining for your portfolio, that they are known by this thing in the US market, like WhatFix is?
2-3 comments on your question, Siddharth. Number one, I still continue to believe that there is no software company to be built unless you can be successful in US. And I hope I'll be wrong soon. And I want to be wrong, actually, genuinely on that. But not yet. I don't think in 10 years I've seen that ability to build a large successful SaaS company with India or Asia as a market. So I think you need to be successful there, number one. And which has been, at least so far, a primary thesis element for us as we back SaaS companies. WhatFix in many ways has defied the patterns. And if I may confess, when I backed WhatFix, my thesis was very different than what WhatFix has turned out to be. I should also confess that WhatFix was championed not by me, but initially by my analyst in Helion, right? I was not even prepared to meet WhatFix, in fact. I thought this doesn't make any sense. And my analyst continued saying, Alok, can you just meet them once? And I declined that also. Until one day he gave me a demo himself, because I refused to even spend half an hour. He gave me a demo. I loved the demo so much. I said, I got to meet. And in my last 10 years, the fastest check I have wrote was WhatFix. In 3 days from my first meeting, I wrote the check. My thesis there was that software is becoming complex enough that you need software to use software. But I thought that this is going to be SMB centric. They were selling for $1,000 price per customer. I thought inside sales motion, which is how Khadim and Vara started. That was my thesis. It actually tells you how not so smart we are as we back things. But they have defied that template. Today, they have 65 Fortune 500 customers, right? They sell, their landed revenue in enterprise accounts is north of $100,000. So the go-to market motion, which was my thesis, is actually not the way WhatFix is built today. And I'm just fortunate that I tagged along for the ride and have learned through that process. But WhatFix is a great example of someone who still came from behind. There was WalkMe in that segment. But today, WhatFix beats WalkMe just in every SaaS metric one can think of. In fact, recently, it's one of those categories that nobody wanted to recognize, which is why there is no major Silicon Valley investor in this category. The first major analyst is Forrester that came out with a full report in this sector. And that's actually only a month back. Imagine, I'm now 8 years into WhatFix. That's how long it has taken for it to be recognized as a category. And they put WhatFix as a number one. And which, certainly very proud of what Khadim and Vara have done. But I also want to admit, it's not the thesis I imagined. But now we have worked with many companies which are targeting the large global corporations. We have Signzy in our portfolio as well. They are even a notch above WhatFix in terms of the kind of size of deals that they do. But we have also done on the reverse side, which is like a Slintel. They started with SMB as the attack point for themselves. But now, as I said, it's very hard to put a pattern to our thesis as well.
And I think last year would have been in the number of companies that you invested, the largest number for your career in SaaS.
You know, Siddharth, we are probably amongst the more measured slow investors. We are blamed for it too. Last year, we saw about 4,000 deals and bagged only 8 companies last year. That's all we did, in fact. There were a few SaaS companies as well. Each of us as investor, I think at best we do 1 to 3 companies in a year. And that's what 2021 was similar. 2022 is similar as well. I think I've done 2 this year, for example. But that's the pace we maintain.
And we have come a long way in 10 years in India SaaS till now, right? As you mentioned, Zoho, Freshworks, and multiple other successful examples. Yeah. iCertis, Drua, Darwinbox, right? Zenoti. How do you think the next 3 to 4 years will play like? Especially seeing, right, we are just started the talks of a recession in US. It's already, right, I think around 100,000 jobs have been cut. SaaS valuations are as low as possible in a decade. Right? Yeah. Companies like Freshworks, who are poster boys of India and growing very well, we just discussed, like more than 25%. They are valued like what, 6x of their, yeah, or 7x of their revenue. So starting right now, we are sitting at end of 2022. How does 2023, 2024, 2025 look like for SaaS?
So maybe I'll give a slightly nuanced answer to this one. Siddharth, you can imagine this is something we worry about every single day. I think first, there are two countervailing forces here. One is, I think, just the secular growth of India SaaS. And the reason I say that is that even when you build a startup, there is a product market fit phase, and then there is a growth phase. I think we have been in our product market fit phase for the last decade, and I would say maybe beginning 2021, we have started the growth phase. And I think that should mean that a lot more new SaaS companies will get created from India. You know, like they say that one Sachin Tendulkar inspires 1,000 others to become a cricketer. They may not become necessarily that. And therefore, now we have enough number of great companies, beginning with, of course, Zoho, Freshworks, BrowserStack, WhatFix, many others.
Mindtickle.
They're inspiring many, many new SaaS founders to come into the foray. I think that's the secular growth from a bottoms-up perspective. And I don't think that that trend is actually ebbing anytime soon. The countervailing force is clearly the down cycle that has begun. I don't think we can now be dismissive about it. Clearly, in every down cycle, public markets are the ones that correct the first. I was reading some stats, I think about a month and a half back, that post, if you look at Q3 numbers in US, the public SaaS multiple is at, the median is 4.3x, actually. And at least I believe that public markets always tend to overreact in both directions, and now they are reacting on the downside. And I don't think that's the end of it yet. I think in every down cycle, initially it's the multiples that correct, and then it's the earnings that correct, while the multiple stays the same. What that means is that we haven't yet begun to see the revenue growth challenges for companies and profitability challenges for companies. And I think there I'm a bit on the bearish side. I think 2023 is going to be a very hard time. What that means is that as public comms correct, or have corrected, I'm sorry, you will see that the late stage funding is going to go for a toss totally. And it's going to create a bit of a havoc, because 2021 saw insane multiples. I'm sure we both know examples of companies raising at a 50x or 100x, right? Imagine now the same company, which is facing a growth challenge on one side, they're running out of cash, they go back to market, now they need to raise, and even a 10x multiple actually is a rich multiple at this point in time. Imagine what that does to your cap table, what it does to all the rights that investors have that begin to kick in as you begin to do down rounds. So I think it's going to be a bit of a havoc. I think it's going to be a painful time for many founders. We just have to bear through that pain. But I think late stage founders particularly will find themselves to be in a tough situation unless they have taken massive corrections on their burn front. Early stage, lesser so. I think I'm at least finding that in early stage, there is actually not much correction on valuations. If you remember, at one point, seed rounds used to be 500K. Then they became a million. Then they became 2 to 3 million. Now I'm often seeing 3 to 5 million seed rounds as well. I am not seeing any significant adjustment to the round sizes at the seed stage. What has gone up is selectivity. People are doing fewer, but the good founders in good new spaces, they're actually still able to raise what they need to raise. Challenge starts from the next round onwards, that there was a time when you are 100K ARR and you could raise at a 50 million pre. That doesn't happen any longer. You just got to show more, even for Series A today. And I think Series A onwards, rounds have become tougher. So I think to that extent, I guess to summarize, on one hand, the growth of India SaaS has attracted more capital, and therefore you will see a lot more people or companies getting created. But on the other hand, I think the environment is also going to put its own pressure. So there'll be some casualties in the process as well.
I'm more interested in is, right, people are able to raise the seed round up to 5 mil, yeah, and they're able to build a product with it. What happens is, once they start scaling to US, hiring is US still tough, right? A $200,000 average salary of a AVP or VP minimum is there. So that kind of a round doesn't suffice for that kind of hiring.
Yeah.
And if the 10 million rounds have disappeared in starting 2022, yeah, and I think they'll not come back till 2024, where will these founders build their go-to-market engines in the US?
So Siddharth, first, I'm of the same opinion as you. I don't think seed round enables you to build a team in the US. Yeah. And again, I'm making a generic statement. There'll be exceptions to it. But 80 to 90% companies cannot build a go-to-market engine in the US. However, I'm not that worried about it. And the reason is that if you look at the remote sales as a capability, initially, the conventional wisdom was you can sell anything for $1,000, $2,000, not more. Then it becomes under $5,000, not more. Then it became $10,000, not more. That 10 became 20, 20 became 30, 30 became 50. 50 has become 100 as well, right? I mean, you go and talk to Khadim and Vara, they'll tell you the $100,000 deals, they get completely end-to-end executed out of India today. And therefore, I guess where I have a difference of opinion is that you don't need to build a physical US go-to-market from the get-go. I also think that the acceptability of remote go-to-market has gone up substantially during COVID as well. Particularly for target segments, which are younger, and I put younger as sort of below 40 years of age, and in the more forward-looking industries.
Dear listeners, if you have been following our podcast, you would have been hearing about Zoho Payroll. Zoho Payroll's mission is to democratize payroll technology for everyone. Hence, they have made a free version of Zoho Payroll for startups and businesses who have up to 10 employees. It has all the features to automate payroll compliance, salary calculations, payments, and much more to pay salaries on time. You can use it for free forever, no questions asked. Even as a startup, give your employees a great payroll experience right from the start. Check out the link in the description to know more about Zoho Payroll. Thank you.
So for a minute, let's keep out things like manufacturing. But if it's services sector, software, many other spaces, fintech, in those cases, the buyers are very astute. They're very comfortable with remote go-to-market. And I think good founders from India will be able to use remote go-to-market to their advantage without actually having a US presence. And I don't think, therefore, they should even attempt to. In fact, I would argue that if they try to attempt and build a US go-to-market team with US people, that is a very high-risk strategy. It can work, but I think it's too high-risk a strategy, in my opinion. Once you raise a Series A, I think that's a better time to put people there. But again, you need to make a judgment call. Does your go-to-market motion require you to have a US team, or it doesn't require you to be? I don't think every company needs to. You can go probably much further in your scale-up before you need that kind of a team. And the last part is that, so that in 2021, you needed to hire somebody in the US. You needed to pay those $300,000, $400,000. Yeah. Look at the number of layoffs that have happened in the US as well. So there is a correction there too. I think it's become a buyer's market and a seller's market in the recruitment process as well today. So that should help. In fact, I think the reverse way around. If you have cash in your bank today, and you needed to build your US go-to-market, today is the best time to hire some great people in the US. And that's what we are trying to do in some of our companies that have raised capital. We are aggressively actually trying to get some high-quality talent, which would have been much harder to get 6 months back also.
And are you like worried about valuation corrections in your portfolio as well? Because companies, in order to raise like a 50 to 100 mil round, right, will need to grow like so much pace, which was much more than 2021. For example, let's say 3x to 4x year on year still now, and above at 20 to 30 mil ARR.
Short answer is yes, we are worried. I think the most important thing for founders in the current situation, in my opinion, is to reduce burn. If you look at, you know, yesterday I was with one of the largest global bankers. I think they're amongst the top three bankers globally. And they were showing me data on multiples in the US market. As you would imagine, that the biggest driver of multiples is your growth. But guess what? That's not the case today. The biggest driver of multiples today is whether you're profitable or you're not profitable, right? So sentiment has changed. Yeah. And we can argue whether it's rational or not rational, doesn't matter, but yes, that's how markets react. And can it change back in 1 or 2 years? I think it can change back also. But given that's the sentiment of the market, the most important thing is to reduce burn. And I think that, especially if you're slightly late stage, I don't think this is going to apply at an early stage. At the later stages, the metric actually I worry about the most is net new ARR added divided by the net burn in a quarter. And if that ratio is more than one, you're healthy. If that ratio is less than one, you're not so healthy. By the way, even half is considered good. But I think today are times where I think I would prefer to be above one on that metric. But I think if you're at that level, that stretches your capital substantially, and extending your runway, I think, is an important goal that founders should have. And it's a tricky balance. You can't forego growth also, because then also you're not relevant. Yeah. So it's going to be a minefield to traverse in the next year or two.
Right now, India would have like approximately 10 companies above 100 mil ARR.
Yeah, roughly.
In SaaS, right? Do you see that number growing significantly, like India being able to add like 10 to 15 companies every year above 100 mil ARR every year?
Without a doubt, Siddharth. Without a doubt. I think that boundary is getting breached so rapidly, at least way beyond my imagination. And there I'll also go back to the fact that the early market leaders, if you look at someone like a Freshworks, and I'm going to pick them out, and maybe Zoho, they had nobody to borrow a template from. They had no advisors to go to. They broke these barriers the very hard way. And as more and more companies are getting created and they're getting scaled, we are seeing talent actually come into the ecosystem. So for example, you know, it took us a while to figure out how to do the 0-1 journey. Then it took us a while to figure out the 1-10 journey. Few companies have, as you said, have done the 10-100 journey as well. So there is a talent available that knows how to do that 10-100 as well. We used to struggle with that a lot in the past. And frankly, even while building WhatFix, I remember that when we were in the 10, 15, 20 million ARR range also, we used to wonder that, look, guys, we just don't have the expertise on how to sort of go to that 50 to 100. But that has changed, and I see, therefore, I think of this as an exponential curve, Siddharth, not as a linear curve. You build one today, you build three tomorrow, you build nine the year after, and then 27 the year after. So I think of it as an exponential journey and not a linear journey.
In a distant future, you imagine that India would produce in a single year like 50 to 100 new 100 mil ARR companies.
Why not? I don't think US produces that many yet, but if we get to it, I have no doubt. Can't comment on the time frame, but I'm sure we will.
But what are the advantages India had? Like Freshworks and Zoho, they had the advantage of building an inbound marketing engine with extremely low cost, build out of Chennai, build out of remote parts of India, and that's how they scaled. And they did it with multiple products. So they were good at creating 0-10 playbooks with multiple products simultaneously, right? Now companies have like a single product which they are going from 0-100 mil ARR journey. The salaries have become also expensive. So the India-US divide is becoming, at least on the developer side, the divide is less and less every year.
And Siddharth, I'll be a little bit contrarian. I actually think that the reason we are successful in SaaS from India is not because of any inherent India advantage. I personally don't even believe in the cost advantage. I don't think great SaaS companies are built because you have lower cost. At least the lower end of the market, if you think of companies as a pyramid and you look at the lower end of the pyramid, that could not be tackled with a US go-to-market. Therefore, we could build me-too companies from India, scale, we had the time. Today, actually, the speed with which new companies come in a space is just scary, right? I mean, initially, it's a race to build the best products, right? And building the best products requires the best talent. And that best talent doesn't come cheap, whether in India or in US, right? Even for the great talent, I understand that there is going to be slightly lower cost in India compared to US. But is that the reason for us to build great companies? I actually don't think so, right? Similarly, on the go-to-market, let's look at very many different kinds of go-to-market. If it's a product-led growth, that product-led growth is being baked in into the product. I don't think there's any inherent India advantage in PLG, in my opinion, right? Similarly, if you go at the enterprise-centric go-to-market, which is feet on street, there again, you have to build it in the regions. There is no advantage in India as well. Yes, there is a bracket in between there where there is an advantage. But to your point earlier, compensation in India has actually gone up as well. And I don't think that that alone is going to be sufficient. You will have to build strong product differentiation. And you will also have to build a very strong distribution engine to be successful. So don't get me wrong. I still think just because of increasing talent, increasing understanding of the US market, finding some early customers even in India who face the same problem as global customers face, we will see a lot more successful companies being created. But I don't think it's because of cost.
Then what is the advantage that, let's say, India has over a long period of time than other markets in creating more number of successful SaaS companies?
In my opinion, actually the advantage is the ecosystem at one point in time, right? I tried starting a company back in 94, right? And clearly I was going to use the word naive, but then I think I was an idiot, I think, to put it simply. But I would also like to believe that if there was a good ecosystem in India, maybe I would have carried our journey further along than I did, right? today, just the experience, again, I go back to my experience curve sort of phrase that I talked about in the beginning. Why is it that Israel continuously creates security companies again and again? Maybe there was a historical reason because of defense sort of proximity. But today they have built that ecosystem and security and they are just able to continuously churn out. I think we have built that ecosystem today. And that ecosystem includes not just the founders, actually founders too, because they have gone through a scaled startup journey in the past. It includes early customers. It includes angels. It includes advisors. It includes capital. And it also includes foreign capital, which is now so keen to come to India. I mean, look at the number of US funds that now want to put money into Indian SaaS companies as well. That engine actually that has been created is the reason that's going to drive success. Not, again, I emphasize, an inherent cost advantage. And not because we have 4 million developers, etc. Because I would argue in those 4 million developers, it's only that very thin slice at the top is actually what matters to these product companies.
Does India have a product advantage also over the US SaaS market yet?
I can't think of it. And the reason is that unless it's a problem that is very unique to India or emerging markets, there I think there will be an advantage because you have proximity to that market. But I'm not a believer of that market to begin with. So at least I don't believe in that advantage. I think at a point when our own market becomes so large and also there are very unique problems to be solved just for our market, I think there that advantage will be there in the product. But in my opinion, not until then.
So Stellaris has been investing in SaaS for the last 5 years.
6 years.
6 years. How has your thesis changed every year? What are your learnings been and what are the factors that contributed to that learning every year?
Great question. Let me first talk about what has stayed similar because then I'll talk about what elements have changed as well. I'm personally a big believer of backing new / emerging categories than existing categories. Not that you cannot build in existing categories, but I think the bar to be successful both on product and go-to-market is so high that there are very few entrepreneurs who I think can scale that kind of mountain, right? I think what Girish did is not an easily replicable recipe in my opinion. I'm more a believer of new and emerging categories because there is a space to find room for yourself in those kinds of markets. And that part has remained constant. The other thing that has remained constant, even though I keep revisiting my thesis every year or every 2 years, is the fact that you need to be relevant or you need to be able to win US, that's important. I think where it has changed, Siddharth, is on a few of the sub-bullets beneath this. Number one is that earlier I would not back a company unless they have customers in the US. There I have changed. And that is because I find that there is now a segment of customers in India whose pain points are very reflective of similar companies in the US as well. And for the sake of argument, let's take an example where you're building a product for SaaS companies, right? And you are able to get a Chargebee or a Capillary or a WhatFix, MoEngage, etc. as customers. I think the chances that your product market fit is going to translate to US product market fit, I would say is very, very high. These companies think and behave the same way as their US counterparts do. So that 0-1 journey where I used to have a lot of hesitation in backing companies, unless they have US customers, at least that part has gone away from my head. So I, of course, look for what kinds of companies are buying your product. If, let's say, an Indian manufacturer were buying your product, I'd be very hesitant because then I would rather want a US manufacturer to buy something from you. But in certain category or segments, I don't hesitate. So I think that's one sort of major deviation for me. Second deviation is that I think we have become a bit bolder in what we underwrite. When we are putting capital in, we are underwriting a certain outcome at which this outcome is going to make sense to us. And I think if Khadim and Vara ever listen to this, they're going to laugh at me. But when I bagged WhatFix from Helion, I bagged with the assumption that in my dream scenario, this company will become a 100 million valuation. And that's, I'm going back to end of 2014.
And what was the valuation when you bagged?
It's not a public figure, but we don't see those kind of seed valuations today.
Okay.
Right? It was very small. But that was the norm of the day. When we started even a few years later at Solaris, that changed too. I remember, I'll continue with the WhatFix example because that's the easiest sort of to take a journey with. I bagged, I still have that spreadsheet, that my dream scenario is that it will reach a valuation of $500 to $600 million. today, actually, I'm comfortable even making a multi-billion dollar assumption. In fact, I've started believing that if you look at it in SaaS mostly, actually there is no upper cap to what you can be. Unless it's a very niche vertical market that I'm talking of, there isn't really a cap there. The question is, how long can you run and how fast can you run? And do the founders still have the imagination and the strength to run that long? That is actually more a challenge as opposed to the exit size as a criteria. But what that means is that I'm prepared to take slightly bolder bets coming in. Like most other people, we have been able to raise the bar on valuations and the amount that we expose at this stage. I'm also become a lot more comfortable in, I think earlier my sweet spot used to be very early, but you still have 4, 5, 6, 7 customers. Maybe early customer, very low revenue, but you have a product, you have some. Most bets I take today are a team with an idea. That's actually what I do. So I think there again, I have changed the orientation a little bit. And now we have bagged, as I said, large enterprise, PLG, SMB centric, open source. Actually, the other big, change in dimension is that I used to believe that most companies from India that can be successful will likely be application companies and not infrastructure companies.
And why is that?
And the reason is that infrastructure actually requires a much deeper tech talent. And it's not that India doesn't have a deeper tech talent, but the density and volume of that tech talent in India that can create a dominating infra companies, at least I used to believe, was much lower than.
So Postman, Hasura, Lambda,
are massive
browser stack.
Are massive exceptions. This see, again, everything I'm saying will have counterexamples to it. Right? Because my thesis was wrong, Siddharth, is why I left Postman. In fact, if I may admit, I couldn't even understand what they did at that point in time. I looked at it at the same time as others did in seed stage. One of my colleagues was very keen, actually, that we do it, but I couldn't even understand the business. And plus that overhang on my head that infra companies, great infra companies are not going to be built out of India. As investors, we get humbled all the time. And this is yet another dimension of humbling ourselves, but we are far more comfortable in backing infra and developer-oriented companies today than we were.
And what has given you the sudden comfort in the last couple of years? The talent density obviously has improved.
I think two things. Number one is some of the successes that, and you have mentioned all those successes, right? Even as investors, right, we clearly, there are some with the foresight who can predict far ahead of the market. Clearly, I was not one of those. But seeing the success of a browser stack, Lambda Test, Hasura, Postman, several others, has given me also the confidence that yes, we can create. Second is also just a number of companies that are coming up in those spaces. And I would say at least for me, something has flipped beginning 2021. If I look at our own diligences in infra and dev versus apps, I think it's roughly now 50-50, which was practically zero or 10% at best in the past. So good founders solving good problems, just seeing a lot more of those. And that's the reason why we have developed more confidence in backing such companies.
And AI and SaaS has been a big thesis for you. Why is that? And how do you see it play out in the next few years when open source AI becoming so commonplace that anybody can incorporate into their SaaS product?
Actually, there are two questions and I'll answer both of them. So Siddharth, either I'll turn out to be the biggest fool or a very smart guy in hindsight. But I genuinely think that the entire software landscape as we know will be recreated. And as I've often said, the last 60-70 years of software can actually be compressed into 4 or 5 cycles. That's it, actually. There is the mainframe era. There is the mini era. There is a client server era. Then there is the 3-tier or the web or the .com, whatever name we give it, was created. And the cloud, right? In fact, I was also amongst those who thought that mobile will be a new era. Didn't turn out to be that way. But I think that AI is going to reimagine, rethink, reinvent all of software as we know it. Why do I believe that way? Is because ever since mainframe to almost today, all the software is about automating what we do. You do debits, credits, and accounting this way. Guess what? SAPs and the Oracles, etc., got created, right? In a call center, you know, when a call comes, needs to be routed, needs to be logged, blah, blah, blah. Siebel's of the world, Vantev's, they got created. I think and I fear also is that for the first time, we are seeing smart, intelligent software that doesn't just automate, that either augments, and if I may say so, replaces humans, right? Let's take a simple example, and there are probably thousands of these already today. I have sold a lot of CR in my career, Siddharth, when I was at Siebel and also at SAP. We saw call centers transformed to email-based support transformed into chat-based support. And we have seen large players come in each of these categories, right? But what if now the chat agent is completely changed by machine, right? And what I'm talking is, by the way, yesterday's concept, not tomorrow's concept already, right? We are now in one such company. They automate already 70% of the conversations.
You're talking about LimeChat.
I'm talking about LimeChat, right? And I think that we are barely scratching the surface, right? You look at the advancements that are happening in NLP, right? And I'll throw buzzwords as everybody does, which is look at what GPT-3 is doing. And since you and I are now in another company together that is breaking the barrier to a different level on what you can do, I think the art of possibility is getting stretched every week. Almost to a scary point, actually, right? So I think that humans will have to rethink what they do pretty soon, right? And I also believe that with every new generation of software, while we always worry about competition, we always believe that, oh, this Salesforce can do it. Well, if Salesforce could do everything, there wouldn't be a sales stack today. There wouldn't be a MarTech stack today, right? Look at the number of unicorns that are created in those stacks too. And frankly, I think of those as small deviations from what they did already. And same for my past employer, SAP, right? They were the only ones in applications at one point in time. In fact, if they got their act together, they wouldn't be in Salesforce today either, right? So I think we sometimes overestimate what existing players can do. I don't think AI is a feature. AI is a different way of thinking the architecture of your software and the capability of software. So everything from product management to engineering, the cycles of releases is going to be completely different. Some incumbents will get their act together. Bulk of the incumbents will not get their act together. And I therefore feel that wait 10 years, much as a data point, which I've mentioned in many forums, but I used to be with Siebel in 2003. And I heard of Salesforce for the first time. And Tom Siebel, who was a founder, he used to make fun of Oracle a lot, but he started making fun of Salesforce also. And we used to believe that, look, this cloud thing, frankly, is this tiny, small shit in the corner. It doesn't matter. I remember we were closing $10 million plus deals. Salesforce was selling to 3 users, 4 users, 5 users. And we used to say that, look, that is not how a software company is built. But then Tom Siebel said, you know, guess what? Maybe to hedge my bets, I'll also have a Siebel on demand. And that's going to kill Salesforce anyway, right? And the reality is that our bread and butter was not coming from there. That's not the only thing we woke up to and slept to, whereas Salesforce was. They innovated in so many different ways. And if you were to fast forward even from now, let's say 2003 to 2013, cloud was a completely different landscape, right? I think in 10 years, AI will be a completely, completely different landscape. And I even shudder to think what that will look like. But I also feel very excited as an investor that whenever there is a massive disruption, lots of new companies will get created. And I know we claim to be very smart, but in some sense, we are also like dart throwers. And we just hope that something sticks somewhere. But if there are a lot of those companies getting created, hopefully one of our darts will stick as well in that process. So I'm very excited about that change.
What are the other categories that excite you besides AI?
I think the other category that excites me is, and it's a very broad canvas I'm going to paint here, Siddharth, is everything to do with developer-centric software. And I think in very simple ways on this, but my thesis is that the amount of new software that is getting created or needs to be created, the pace of growth of that is far higher than the number of new software developers. For that equation to add up, software productivity just has to go up. There is no other way, or we will not have the software, right? So the demand exists, supply doesn't exist. And so the supply has to scale faster. And the only way supply will scale faster is when developer productivity goes up. And all the tool sets for developers, therefore, I think is going to be a massive area of value creation as well. It can be simple things as things, let's say, which help you in your DevOps, things that help you in automatic code generation, things that actually help you in testing, things that help you in reading your code and figuring out where the gotchas might lie, privacy issues might lie. There are just, if you look at the entire life cycle, right? Yesterday, I met someone who is now thinking about what kind of tooling do you need to continuously retrain models, right? Imagine Spotify, right? And I was giving this example to a colleague of mine in the morning. I listened to old Hindi songs from the 50s and 60s, right? Whereas my daughters are trying to get me into Western music, which I've never really heard. But some old songs in English also I've begun to listen. Imagine now, see, Spotify is giving me recommendations. There's a model behind me. What if I start listening to a song from Simon and Garfunkel and Billy Joel? Now, does the model need to retrain itself in the next minute, next hour, next day, next week? And what data points from my past versus today does it capture to retrain the model? And the workbenches that you require, all those are about developer productivity as well, right? So at least I am very bullish on that broad space. I'm not a developer as much to be able to dissect it with sort of more nuance at this stage, but I'm very, very bullish about that area.
And what are the things that you think are outdated that you will not touch?
Great question. I think if largely process automation, not that I will not back, but I'm going to ask myself probably 5 times as many questions as I did in the past. I'm also of the view that most software will become invisible in the future, in the sense that historical model is I go to a software, the new model is software comes to you. It comes where you are. Whether you're in Slack, whether you are in your email, wherever it is, it just comes to you. And if somebody builds a software where as a user I have to go, again, I think about it differently. I'm also of the belief that there was a time where you could push software purely top down. You go to a CIO and say, you need this, and users, guess what, you need to use it. You may not think as a user it's beneficial to me, but guess what, you have to use it, right? I think that era is going to become much harder. You need to have a value proposition at the level of a user and not just their managers or managers or managers or the leadership. And again, Siddharth, every sentence I'm making, there'll be exceptions to it too, right? Ours is a business of exceptions in the end. But in these categories, I'll think actually a lot harder.
And there are some categories like marketing automation, sales for automation, RevOps, and companies building SaaS for SaaS, right? So these are categories which are hugely populated, 50 to 100 players in each category.
My view, Siddharth, those entire stacks are going to be reimagined. So I understand that both the marketing stack and the sales stack have become very crowded and are things that investors don't want to touch. But as I said earlier, I think you will find that a very different categories of companies are going to be created through use of AI today that will reimagine those spaces too. I mean, frankly, in our portfolio, we have GTM Buddy, for example. They're just rethinking how sales enablement should be thought about using AI. And I don't think that the seismics and the high spots of the world are going to get there. I know that's a very strong statement to make, but I just don't think they will. And like that, lots of new companies will get created all over again in the same stack that existed.
Alok, you also mentioned earlier in the podcast that now you are very comfortable backing founders at idea stage where everything is changeable.
Yeah.
What gives you so much comfort to back there now? Are you able to spend like a lot of time with the founders to know them deeply and know what their motivations are and why are they excited about a particular space?
I think it's more my own learning, Siddharth, more than anything else right now. My journey at SAP India itself, not the US part of it, but just in India, sort of traversed from the $100 million to the $500 million. That's the part I was comfortable with. That's what I understood. And Khadim always used to give me this feedback that, Alok, you just don't understand early stage. And that's the truth. I didn't. And I'm realizing that as I'm spending more time in venture, I'm just becoming more and more comfortable going more early stage than I was. So I think a lot of what I said is more because of my own comfort now than because of anything else. I think it's partly also because of the, when there were very few proofs of success in the ecosystem, you find it hard to underwrite with nothing. You need to see something to be able to make a projection. Now that there are a lot more successes, we just need lesser data ourselves to underwrite things. And therefore, again, I've become comfortable at the idea stage itself. And last part is that I've just begun to enjoy that very early stage now just a lot more. When you are still trying to figure out which problem to solve, what product to solve it with, what do I say to the customer when I knock on the door, and frankly, which customer's door should I knock in the first place? That period of confusion, ambiguity is actually where I've started to enjoy a lot.
And just going back to that thought, right, where you are backing founders at idea stage, what are the things in your checklist? As an investor, you definitely have a checklist, right, that a founder must have, right, when you take them to your IC.
This is a question I wish I had an answer to, actually. Not just for you, but even for my colleagues at Stellaris. Again, these are very cliched statements, Siddharth, but when we are backing someone, we do recognize that whoever we are going to back is going to iterate on the product and it'll take some time to figure out the exact problem and the solution. But there is a broad space that we still need a conviction with. And we do spend a lot of time in both formulating conviction on that broad space. We need to believe that this is a must-solve problem. And we are also looking for some unique insights that the founder provides in that space. And again, I'm going to take the example of GTM Buddy, but the way it started was that, if you know Anish Reddy, Anish has been both a friend and a mentor, frankly, in the SaaS journey, at least for me. Anish introduced me to Sridhar. In fact, that introduction was not even to do an investment. It was just to have a chat. He said that, look, you have done sales in your past life. Sridhar is thinking of sales enablement as a space. And why don't you guys have a chat? Sridhar has never done sales in his life, by the way. But he has this uncanny ability to go to like a fourth, fifth layer of depth in a conversation that most human beings are not able to. And I was surprised that while I'm a career sales guy, Sridhar has never done anything but engineering and product. But the insightfulness with which he could go into the pain points, a day in the life of what will make a difference to that, that actually I was totally, I'm missing vocabulary in English, but I was going to use the word spellbound by, but yeah, I was quite amazed.
Blown away.
Thank you so much. Blown away by. So we are also looking for some unique insights. We do, by the way, have a checklist. We have a fairly detailed founder framework that we go with. That framework is more to make sure that we are exploring different sides of the personality or the skill sets of the founder. But the core of what we are trying to achieve in that diligence is that, is there a spike in this founder or not? At least we believe, Siddharth, that there is no perfect founder. There is no perfect human being, actually. And people succeed despite their flaws. People succeed because there is some spike that they have that actually covers up for all their flaws. So our focus while evaluation is less on what they are not good at, but more about, is there something where they truly excel? And that something is what is going to enable them to pull through in a clutter of companies and founders. And therefore, as you can imagine, it's a bit of an amorphous exercise. And that framework I talked about is more to explore different sides of the personality so that you are able to figure that gem in their personality. But that's the broad framework that we use.
But is that a general framework, or is it for only for SaaS founders?
No, that's a general framework.
You find that people who have also inexperience with SaaS, if they match the framework, they are very highly likely to create exceptional companies.
They can. And you know, it's interesting you say that, and I've spent a lot of time talking about Sridhar. At the same time, I bagged LimeChat. Now, they couldn't be poles apart. LimeChat is founded by two founders, Aniket and Nikhil, both IIT Delhi grads, computer science, very young guys. Just exceptionally brilliant. I mean, you have a chat with them, you just get blown away with these folks. In fact, when I spoke to them the first time, I was trying to learn about MLOps as a space. And it was more a knowledge or a knowledge gaining exercise on my part. And I remember we hung up on that call and I had two other colleagues with me. And I said, man, these guys are so brilliant. We just got to be working with them. And I had never backed founders that young in SaaS. I always used to believe that in B2B businesses, you need to have a certain level of experience. But I think there is no template for a great founder. There is no recipe. In fact, the reason they're successful is because they don't adhere to a template in the first place. Like LimeChat founders, they're like sponges. Their learning agility is so scary. And their energy levels are off the charts. And their ambitions are sky high that I think they'll build something great. Doesn't matter whether they have experience or they have no experience.
And in SaaS, right, the other customer, right, in consumer, so you can get a knack of what consumer wants and then try to deliver. The end customer, in most cases, is the enterprises who have a lot of money. And they think, and you have been the other end of the buyer. They think in a certain way, they operate in a certain way. They have, you know, a 3 to 6 months buying period. How do founders traverse this when you are evaluating them, whether they will be able to traverse these enterprises or not, whether they will be able to navigate these complex, you know, organisms?
So Siddharth, I have become a lot more comfortable in not even having an answer to some of those questions at the very early stage. And the reason is that, see, I feel that as an investor, there are some things you can test for, there are some things you can't test for. Right? It's like, to begin with, our business is about meeting a 2-year-old and trying to figure out whether that kid is going to become a Tendulkar or not. But if you try to get too detailed, whether they can hit a square drive like a Tendulkar or not, I think that data point just doesn't exist. So me trying to even figure out how to judge it, I'm actually going down a path which is not even a possibility actually in the first place. So I think certain risks we take come with the stage. Some will cross that boundary, some will not cross that boundary. Right? And therefore, there is going to be some failures, some successes. And I think I have become comfortable with that idea. I'm not. In fact, I'll argue the reverse. Because I came from a go-to-market background, I think I was trying to put too high a benchmark on at least the go-to-market capability of founders. And it's not even funny how many times I've been wrong, Siddharth. I wish I had taken many of those bets. And the reality is, I think we need to judge people for their learning capability, not their prior knowledge of the problems and the solutions to those problems. And if they have not encountered those solutions, they actually cannot even have a good framework of thinking actually about those problems. So I can't judge them, right? So let's take a very crude example. Should you have an inbound demand gen engine or an outbound demand engine, right? And guess what? The founders have not even built a product. They don't even know whether they'll find product market fit with the larger enterprises or with the SMBs. How can I judge, or how can they judge rather, whether it'll be inbound or outbound? One doesn't know. Also, if they come from purely engineering backgrounds, they don't even have a muscle of thinking about it in the past, right? So there is no framework. So if I try to judge those things, I think I'm more likely to decline because of reasons that I should not be judging on. So I now judge very few things also when I'm actually backing people.
And if you had to reiterate, what were those few things, right? One, you mentioned learning agility.
So I would say learning agility and insightfulness are probably the top of the stack for me.
And if I have to, you know, summarize your experience as an investor in the last 10 years, right? You completed a decade. What has worked for Alok Goel and why?
I used to be a consultant for 6 years, initially at McKinsey and then a firm called McKenna Group in the Bay Area. And I had a partner called Pam Klein. And Pam Klein, by the way, is now an advisor to WhatFix. But, you know, one of those people that I put at a very high pedestal. And as I was getting into my sales role in consulting, she used to tell me, Alok, there is no recipe to be a good salesperson. Figure out what works for you. Figure out what advantages you can draw from yourself. And don't worry about the rest. And I think investing is very similar. I don't think there is any unique background you need or any unique trait you need. For example, I derive energy from meeting people, right? I'm not the guy who is best at thinking alone. I actually enjoy thinking on a whiteboard with two other colleagues, saying a statement, negating myself just 2 minutes later, iterating on it. But you just say, Alok, think about this for an hour and come back. I'll still have a blank sheet and not much to show for it. So because I derive my energy from meeting people, at least what I have done consistently over the last 10 years, I just meet a lot of founders, a lot of people in general in the ecosystem, trying to learn what has worked for them, what has not worked for them as well, and hopefully just improving my own thinking basis that. And I think the second thing, which is always important in our profession to realize, is that as investors, sometimes we give ourselves way too much credit than we deserve. We are actually just a conduit for the money supply chain. It's somebody else's money, goes to somebody else. We just happen to put our signatures on that checkbook. We think we change the world, we don't. It's clearly the entrepreneurs who change the world. And not over-enforcing ourselves in the company that we are part of, I think is just very important. You know, if WhatFix had listened to most things I had said, I think they'll be dead 5 years back. The reason they're successful is because they apply their own judgment. And I'm not saying that everything I've said was wrong, but we sit at a distance. Ultimately, they are the ones who are close. And we need to recognize our own place, which is we are sounding boards. We are well-wishers. Our incentives are aligned to theirs. But the day we start believing that we know the answers and we know the truth, I think the recipe for disaster has already started cooking itself by that time. So,
and Alok, imagine you have to pass over the baton and Stellaris would be a $500 million to $1 billion fund in next 5 to 10 years. You have to pass over the baton to a colleague, right? And you would look for some similarity, right? Not a completely different. What would those be?
I'm not, by the way, looking to turn my back on investing just yet until I learn that I can't invest. But I certainly will not look for any similarities with me. I just think that every investor, in fact, in many ways, I would much rather prefer people who think very differently than I do. See, even in our partnership, now we are an investment team of 10 people, but even the three partners who started, I think we're poles apart in the way we think, in the way we evaluate. And that gives you a richness of conversations and different ways of looking at the same thing that would not have come had we all thought the same way. So I don't know the answer to your question, Siddharth, but the one answer I do know is that it better be someone who is certainly not like me.
Thank you so much, Alok. I really enjoyed our conversation. I learned a lot from this conversation, and I hope, you know, my audience is able to take away the nuggets which I took away from this conversation. And this helps like thousands of SaaS entrepreneurs at least avoid a few mistakes that you have seen in the last decade, and you are able to convey through this, you know, a conversation.
No, thank you, Siddharth. I've enjoyed as well. This is the second time I've been on this platform. Really enjoyed our first conversation, and this even more so. You always force us to introspect about ourselves, which is a very useful process for us as well. Thank you so much.